ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. Hi, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT Radio, we discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest diet for humans.
We also discuss how animals have certain inherent rights, just as we humans do.
And we discuss the impact on the environment eating meat has.
And we try to bring all these ideas together so that our listeners can make informed choices on how they choose to live their lives.
On today's show, we feature a conversation with Mike Hudak, the founder and director of Public Lands Without Livestock, and also author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. Thanks for being with us on ACT Radio, Mike.
Thank you, Greg.
We're really happy to have you here today. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got interested in the subject of grazing on public lands?
Sure. It really happened in two stages. I began hiking on public lands in the West in the early 1990s. And I encountered in these hikes a lot of impacts of grazing, although I didn't really understand them. I saw eroded streams. I saw meadows that looked like golf courses. I saw high elevation forests populated by livestock. And all of this seemed very strange to me. I became involved in doing some travelogue-type presentations for groups such as the Sierra Club. And somehow during this time, I became aware of Lynn Jacobs' book, Waste of the West.
Yeah, it's an excellent book.
And this was in early 1993. I contacted Lynn, spoke with him on the phone, bought a copy of his book, and began incorporating information from that book into my presentations. But I didn't take a real serious interest in public land grazing itself until about 4 years later. And that happened in 1997 when I was actually already focusing on forest protection issues. As you may recall, forest protection was sort of like the major issue of the mid-90s, particularly in the Sierra Club. There was a movement within the club to have the Sierra Club oppose logging on public lands.
Yeah.
I was not involved in that, but I was aware of what was going on. After the club's policy had already been changed in 1996, I went out to the West, did a lot of photography in the ancient forests of the Pacific Northwest, and started developing a show about that, which I was doing back here in the East. And in the course of doing one of those shows to a private foresters association here in upstate New York, an audience member asked me, what is the Sierra Club doing about grazing on public lands?
Well, that was a very pointed question.
That's right. And I said, well, I don't know, but I'll find out. And I did. I read the Sierra Club's grazing policy. I was quite dismayed by it. I felt it was a policy that could have been written by the livestock industry.
Didn't have much teeth behind it, in other words.
That's right. It basically recognized that grazing was here to stay and that the best that we could hope for would be to manage it for the better health of the land. I thought, well, I'm going to go out west and investigate this. So I set out in the summer of 1997 for about 5.5 months. Drove 20-some thousand miles around the West, talking with every activist and land manager that would speak with me. I then came back and started doing presentations about it. I also became more aware of how the Sierra Club operated, how policies can get changed. I paid a lot of attention to what the forest activists had done in terms of changing the logging policy. And then beginning in 1998, I, for the most part, took over a campaign to change the Sierra Club's grazing policy. And that went on for 2 years. And finally, in the fall of 2000, we actually did achieve some improvements in that grazing policy. And the grazing committee that exists in the Sierra Club today grew out of that. So that's the very short explanation of how I got into this, how I became interested in it. Some of it was my personal experience initially, and then it was just a coincidence that a person asked that question at one of my forest presentations. And it set me off in a completely different direction.
Well, one of the notable things about your book, Turf Wars, is that the interviews range from longtime government agency personnel to grassroots activist types. And these are people that you met while you were on your journey through the West.
Well, yeah, some of these people I already knew before I started working on the book, because I'd been doing these investigations for 6 summers before I started working on the book. So a lot of those people I already knew. I knew of some of these people through the RangeNet listserv.
That's the email list that you administer?
Well, I don't administer that. Larry Walker, the retired range conservationist from the BLM, administers that.
Oh, yeah?
That's right. It's his listserv. He started it in 1997. And so that was a tremendous resource for me in terms of contacting people. I also found people through PEER, which is Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. And then I also met additional people simply through the course of doing the interviews.
Well, considering the diverse nature of the people you interviewed, from government employees to grassroots activists, do you find that they all had similar motivations about grazing?
Yes, I do. I would say some of the management people wouldn't necessarily go so far as to say that all livestock grazing needed to end. That might be a little bit of a difference.
Well, then they sort of lose their jobs, I suppose, if there was nothing to manage.
Sure, but of course, most of these people were already retired. There was only one person I interviewed from the agencies who wasn't retired.
Uh-huh.
And when I discovered he wasn't retired, I actually attempted to talk him out of doing the interview.
Right.
Because I told him that this might not be good for his career.
Uh-huh.
But he said no, he wanted to go through with it. And it turned out he actually did lose his job before the book came out. I anticipated completing the book much more quickly than I did. But in the meantime, he lost his job, and he's now working for another agency.
Well, what about these agency people and their opinions upon how ranchers manage the public lands? Because we've read a lot about how, you know, out here in the West, we have a fragile, arid ecosystem, and the cows, being more mesic animals, tend to congregate in the riparian areas, and they do tremendous amount of damage to these, and these areas are critical for maintaining healthy watersheds in the West. How do the managers reconcile their management of these cattle in areas that are so critical to protecting water resources here in the arid West?
I think a lot of these people went through an educational process during their times in the agencies. And so I think when they started out as young natural resource people, that they didn't have any preconceived notions about that, and that they learned about those impacts on the job. And then they, I think, came to conclusions very similar to what you just said. And then, of course, they also learned the politics that exists within these agencies, and they saw what happened to other people, their colleagues who spoke out. Typically, these people who did speak out in various ways were either thwarted, that is, they were told to modify their views, or political pressure was brought to bear on them, and they were moved out to another location. So that's happened again and again. And so I think those stories go a long way. People know what the conclusion will be if they speak out. And so very few of them choose to do that now because they know what the result will be for them.
Besides compacting the earth and contributing to soil erosion and native plant extinctions and damage to streams, can we talk for a minute about what cattle grazing does to the wildlife of the West?
There's the direct impact, and then, of course, there's indirect impacts, the indirect ones coming through things like animal damage control, for instance,
right,
which has a severe impact on animals that are viewed as a threat or as a competitor to the livestock industry. Those animals are, to a large extent, eliminated. And, of course, there are side effects of that, too. One of the interviewees in my book, Renee Galliano-Pop, spoke about poisoning of coyotes, which was indirectly also poisoning red foxes. And here was an interesting mindset on her part, that she wasn't all that concerned about the impact of the killing on the coyotes, because she said there was a lot of scientific data showing that they could be killed in substantial numbers without that actually extirpating a population of them. But she said there was no data about red foxes, for instance, and she knew a significant number of them were being killed. And yet the animal damage control people were not concerned about that in the least.
Also, animal damage control, wildlife services have virtually eliminated prairie dogs. And at the same time, they've eliminated black-footed ferrets who rely solely on the prairie dogs for food. And yet at the same time, we're spending millions of dollars trying to reintroduce black-footed ferrets. Seems like an incredible waste of money.
Well, an incredible waste of life, Greg. All the wildlife that is dying. And then the direct impacts are such as we were talking about before, removing the food base for the natural herbivores in the system. That would be one of the major direct impacts of having livestock there. And then, of course, ruining the water resources.
Right. Yeah, one thing I heard from agency people all over the West was a sense that the productivity of these grazed lands is in decline. And I think the agencies don't want to acknowledge that. They'll say, well, yes, a lot of degradation was done in the 19th century before the government really got its management in place with the Forest Service and then the BLM. But I think what is not acknowledged is that even with this management, that the productivity has been in decline, and that that is going to impact and probably has impacted wildlife populations. As one of my speakers said, Patrick Deal, who was an activist in southern Utah, this land is in decline, and that if it just goes on as it is, it will be essentially ungrazable in 40 or 50 years due to the loss of productivity of the land and the invasion of cheatgrass and other weeds and such. And so you really will have biological deserts in these regions.
In light of all the damage that grazing does, one movement that's recently gained some ground is this holistic ranching movement, and that's supported by some groups in New Mexico. And these groups tend to advocate that we have to have herbivores grazing these western lands in order to keep the grasses growing and healthy. And I think this is an area that people really need some education about. What's the truth behind these holistic ranching scenarios?
Well, I didn't have any of the interviewees saying anything much good about holistic resource management. People criticized it in regard to its impacts on ground nesting birds. Other people spoke about the difficulty of actually implementing it, and even one person spoke about his personal association with Alan Savory. But from a scientific point of view, holistic management or holistic resource management, as the name has been called at various times, this has all been thoroughly critiqued by people like George Werthner and Joy Belsky and other people. Jeff Burgess, I think, has an article on the Internet. So it isn't something that I focused on in a real scientific way. George Werthner has an excellent chapter in his book, Welfare Ranching, about it. He has a similar article on the Internet. My approach in the book was not to focus so much on data, but on people's experiences with these issues and with the people involved with those issues, to give people who read this a personal perspective and say, look, the scientific data has been presented elsewhere, although I do reference it in the end notes of my book. But that was not really the focus of my book.
Well, I think it's a really interesting approach to focus on the history of how people come to understand the impacts of grazing on public lands. What is the status of the movement to reform or even end livestock grazing on public lands today? Do you think this is a movement that's already peaked?
Well, I would say that it's at a lower level of activity than it was 4 or 5 years ago, sadly.
And what do you think, Brad, about that?
That's a complex issue. As I said, there certainly was more activity going on in the early years of this decade. There were annual RangeNet conferences. We had the National Public Lands Grazing Campaign, which was attempting to organize people around the idea of having federal legislation to buy out federal grazing permits. Sadly, money for that campaign dried up about a year and a half ago. The activity of that campaign is at a much reduced state today. The legislation that the campaign was promoting is no longer in the Congress. I'm working with people in the Sierra Club to see that that's reintroduced. I don't know all of the reasons why it's declined. I think there's been a decline in many areas of environmentalism just in the last 5, 6, 7 years. Perhaps reflect just the general culture, maybe a kind of malaise that has settled onto the movement as a result of the Bush administration. I can tell you that many of the venues at which I gave presentations about public lands ranching in the late 90s and early years of this decade don't even exist anymore. EarthSafe chapters that have gone out of existence, Sierra Club groups that no longer hold monthly public informational meetings. So from simply the point of view of a public speaker, I see that as kind of a closing in of the world on me. It's a difficult situation.
Well, do you have any hope for the future?
Well, we'll see in terms of how much success I have in promoting my book. That still is an unanswered question, and I think we'll know in another 6 months or so how successful I am at scheduling presentations at environmental organizations and colleges.
Mike, can you tell our listeners where they can go to get more information about Turf Wars?
Sure. I have a website. The link to that website is the title of the book, westernturfwars.com, and they can find more information about the book, and they can also buy it online.
Also, don't you have some of the interviews online as well?
That's right. Actually, the book started off as a video project. When I conceived of this whole project in 2002, I had no intention of writing a book. I wanted to do something that no one else had done, and that was to put free videos of interviews onto the internet. And it was only after I had done that to some extent in 2003 that I realized I had so much information that really did not lend itself to online videos that I decided to compile it into a book.
Well, it's a great book, Mike, and you've done a real great service to everyone that wants to get more educated about the impacts of cattle grazing on Western lands. So we encourage all our listeners to go to westernturfwars.com to learn more. And thanks for being with us today, Mike.
Thank you, Liz and Greg.
Well, we've learned a lot today about how eating beef impacts our public lands. And if you want to learn more about a vegetarian diet, you can contact the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at 877-3030.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh for the Animals, the Earth, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.